Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the profile of the white supremacist gunman who shot up a Sikh temple, killing six worshippers and gravely wounding three others and a police officer. Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of their quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report, and the Hate Watch blog, joins us to discuss the lethal combination of permissive gun laws in Wisconsin and ignorant racists susceptible to Fox News propagandists spewing anti-Muslim distortions and diatribes, as well as reckless hate speech from politicians like Michelle Bachmann. Then we'll examine the phenomenon of Christian terrorism that largely goes unreported. Mark Juergensmeyer, the director of the Center for Global and International Studies at UC Santa Barbara and author of the bestseller Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence, and the recently released Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State, joins us. Then finally, we will learn about the Sikh faith, the Seekers of Truth, the world's fifth largest religion, members of which in the United States have been subjected to a 1,600% rise in anti-Muslim violence since 9/11, according to the FBI. Gurinder Singh Mand, professor of Sikh studies and the director of the Center for Sikh and Punjab Studies, and Ami Shah, an expert on Sikh literature, join us. And joining us now is Mark Potok, who is the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. Mr. Potok leads one of the most highly regarded operations monitoring the extreme right in the world today. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as the key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Congress, the U.S. Senate, and the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
A true pleasure.
This fellow that killed six people in the Sikh temple in Wisconsin, Wade Michael Page, apparently he's come up on your radar. You've got some information about him.
Yeah, we've been aware of him for probably something like about 10 years now. And in fact, Wade Michael Page was very much a part of the movement going all the way back, that is the white supremacist movement, going all the way back to the year 2000. He's a guy who at that point started to become very deeply involved in the white supremacist music scene. He is, in fact, a singer and a guitarist who now has his own band, a band called End Apathy, which he started in the year 2005.
So he's been described as a frustrated neo-Nazi?
Yes, I described him as a frustrated neo-Nazi after reading through an interview with him early this morning with a particular white supremacist website. And I did so because he talks in this interview about the reason that he named his band End Apathy. And he spoke specifically about the idea of being frustrated with how slowly the movement was moving forward. In fact, he said, and I quote, "The inspiration," and he's talking about forming his band, "was based on frustration that we have the potential to accomplish so much more as individuals in a society and whole." He doesn't go on and explicitly talk about violence. He doesn't talk about Muslims or Sikhs or anything like that. But I will tell you that the band he was a part of and some of the other bands he played with, are just at the heart of the most violent white supremacist ideology you can imagine. These groups, these musical groups, sing about, killing all the Jews, killing all quote-unquote race mixers, murdering black people, murdering gay people, and so on. It's an incredibly violent world, at least in terms of what they talk about. Of course, most people who are in white supremacist bands or in the white supremacist world in general don't go out and commit mass murders, but a fairly high proportion of them, certainly compared to other sectors of the population, do.
Well, Mark Potok, this fellow is apparently a former U.S. Army member who was discharged for patterns of misconduct, and he was busted down from a sergeant down to a specialist and made ineligible for reenlistment. Apparently, he was a former psychological operations specialist and a Hawk missile system repairman. The idea of this man being in PSYOPs is pretty extraordinary. I despair at the state of the U.S. Army.
Well, it may be worth pointing out that as long ago as 2006, we, in fact, wrote a major investigative story talking about the presence of white supremacist extremists in the armed forces. Essentially, what we said at that time was the armed forces were bringing in fairly large numbers of these people, not on purpose, of course, but they were essentially looking the other way when, say, a guy had a swastika tattoo on his back or something along those lines, because they were having such trouble meeting the recruitment quotas to deal with the wars, of course, in Iraq and Afghanistan. We spent the next several years essentially battling back and forth with the Pentagon, first under Bush and then, in fact, under Obama, trying to get them to adopt a zero-tolerance policy toward having people like this in the military. Ultimately, in the late fall, in November, December of 2009, the Pentagon, in fact, did change its regulation in accordance with what we'd asked, but it took them quite a little while to do so. Now, you know, I must say that there's no evidence that this man, the alleged mass murderer in Milwaukee, was in fact part of the extremist world while he was in the military. We just don't know that. It may well be. What we know is he left the military in 1998, and in 2000, he has talked about joining the kind of white supremacist music scene and so on.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. Mark Potok leads one of the most highly regarded operations monitoring the extreme right in the world today. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as the key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center. So it seems to me, though, and I'm wondering whether your research would support this, that this man targeted the Sikhs in this temple in Wisconsin based upon the misapprehension that they were Muslims because they wear turbans and have beards. And since 9/11, Sikhs have been the victims of a lot of arbitrary violence perpetrated by anti-Muslim Americans who are not only racist, but they're stupid because they don't know, in fact, that the Sikhs are not Muslims.
That's exactly right. I think that's precisely right. I feel almost dead certain that this man thought he was targeting Muslims. You know, I will say from my own experience that there is virtually no propaganda in the white supremacist world and the radical right about the evils of Sikhs. All they talk about, in fact, is Muslims, you know, when they're not talking about their other enemies, gay people, black people, brown people, Jews, and so on. But there's essentially no animus that I've ever spotted really directed at the Sikh world. But the sad reality is there are a lot of very ignorant people out there who can't tell the difference. You know, there's been some 11 years of news about the fact that Sikhs are not Muslims. But apparently this fellow went out and had to kill a whole bunch of people anyway. So I think that's almost certainly what's going on out there.
Well, not only did he kill six in the temple, he also gravely wounded a local police officer, Lieutenant Brian Murphy, who is in critical condition, as are, I think, three other people as well. He was able to get off a lot of shots. He ambushed the police officer, Lieutenant Brian Murphy, firing, I think, 9 bullets at close range into him. It's a miracle that the police officer survived so far. You can't help linking this to another issue, gun control, because Wisconsin just passed a law in 2011 allowing citizens to carry concealed weapons, and Wisconsin has some of the most permissive gun laws in the state. So there's no question that this man was able to get into this temple, was able to ambush a police officer, and did he have a concealed permit, or is one required in Wisconsin? Apparently you don't. The law that was passed in 2000.
Well, So, I mean, as a general matter, I don't think there's much question that these extremely permissive gun laws play a role in at least some of these mass murders. That seemed pretty clearly to be the case in Denver recently, for instance, you know, where it's hard to believe, you know, it's hard to understand why a hunter would ever need these 100-round clips and so on that have become legal in this country. But I think it's a little too early to say what role gun control might or might not have played in this mass murderer's attack.
Well, but what we can say is that the combination of permissive gun laws and the propaganda that is in the mainstream media, Fox News, for example, Mark Potok, endlessly puts forth anti-Muslim conspiracy theories about Sharia law being imposed, about President Obama being a Muslim. It is a constant drumbeat.
Oh, so, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, it's Fox News. It is certain opportunistic politicians out there. It is people like Pam Geller and Rob Spencer, these people who put out absolutely false propaganda about Muslims. You mentioned Sharia law. I mean, that's a classic. The idea that there is a secret Muslim plot to impose Sharia law on the United States is ludicrous on its face. And I say that because it is not possible under the U.S. Constitution to impose Islamic religious law on this country. And yet you have, in many cases, well-known politicians, cable news anchors and so on, talking about Sharia law. Now we have Oklahoma and, you know, I don't even know the latest count of
Kansas
how many states have passed these laws, these nonsensical laws. But, you know, it's not merely a matter to be amused or bemused by, because the reality is that all of this agitation results in, you know, some people out there, a pretty significant proportion of the American population, who really do believe that there are, you know, nefarious, wicked plots being carried out within the United States, that there are Muslim Brotherhood operatives in the State Department and all the rest. So, you know, when you have quote-unquote responsible politicians and people with television or radio audiences numbering in the hundreds of thousands or millions, and they're saying these kinds of things, you can't be entirely surprised when someone goes out and tries to blow up a mosque or murders a bunch of Sikh people or whatever it may be. So, I mean, what I'm saying is that...
Well, you're actually obliquely referring, Mark Potok, to Michelle Bachmann's recent jihad against the State Department, in particular the chief aide to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who Bachmann, along with a number of fellow House Republicans, have accused Hillary Clinton's aide of being a secret member of the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's not as if it's happening not just at Fox News. It is happening in the corridors of power at the highest levels of the U.S. government, that this kind of pernicious ignorance is being propagated. And that seems to be a lethal mixture. The availability of guns without the need to even have a concealed carry permit in Wisconsin, and this drumbeat of propaganda. You mentioned Pam Geller. She, of course, was the inspiration for Breivik, the mass murderer in Norway.
She and her partner, Robert Spencer, were certainly among the inspirations, Spencer in particular. Look, I mean, I think that what we are talking about is our own Anders Breivik. You know, and for those who don't recall, Anders Breivik murdered 77 of his countrymen in Norway in July of last year, of 2011, because he thought that they were enabling Muslim immigration into a country that had been largely Christian and white until very recently. You know, at the time, I think everybody who does the kind of work that I do worried very seriously that we could see precisely the same kind of thing happen here. Now, I suppose we're lucky in the sense that thus far only six people are dead, although it will certainly be more before this is all out. But, you know, the reality is this man tried to, allegedly, carry out a mass murder along the lines of what Breivik did in Norway. So, you know, this is a terrible, terrible problem. It is not restricted to the United States. We're seeing the same kind of really vicious Islamophobia in both Eastern and Western Europe. And, you know, it is leading to serious episodes of criminal violence.
So, Mark Potok, who do we hold responsible here? I mean, we mentioned Michelle Bachmann's role in stirring the pot and in this reckless way, accusing not only, she said a third of the House of Representatives are communists, I think. Was that Alan West?
Alan West, 70.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she also said that there are a lot of her colleagues were communists as well. I don't know that what figure she gave of the percentage, but now she's on the anti-Muslim bandwagon, as well as Louis Gohmert and a bunch of her colleagues. Why not hold Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes responsible? What? How do these people?
Well, I mean, look, as a matter of law, of criminal law in this country, it would be very, very difficult. Perhaps under civil law, you might be able to get some kind of a judgment. But, you know, the reality is that under the First Amendment, you can stand on a street corner or on a podium in front of 10,000 people and say we should kill all the Jews or we should kill all the Muslims, and that is completely protected speech. You know, there's a narrow exception for direct criminal incitement, but the circumstances you would have to have in order to get a criminal conviction in such a case are very, very specific. So, you know, what kind of responsibility do these people have? The opportunists, the politicians, the radio show hosts, the cable news hosts, the sort of professional Islamophobes like Pam Geller? Well, I mean, what I would say is they have a very, very definite moral responsibility. They won't be going to prison for murder or inciting murder, but the reality is it's the lies and the propaganda from people like this who ultimately make possible the kind of carnage we saw over the weekend in Milwaukee.
Thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Potok.
Well, I appreciate it very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. Mr. Potok leads one of the most highly regarded operations monitoring the extreme right in the world today. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama, and he's testified before the Congress, the U.S. Senate, and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights.
Because a few of them were white, and it's the same across the nation. Black and white discrimination, yeah, and you can't understand me, and all that other jazz they hand me in the papers and TV, and all that mass stupidity that seems to grow more every day. Each time you hear something we'd say, he wants to go and do you in, cause the color of your skin just don't appeal to him, no matter if it's black or white, because he's out for blood tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Juergensmeyer, who's the director of the Orfalea Center for Global and International Studies, professor of sociology and professor of religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's an expert on religious violence, conflict resolution, and South Asian religion and politics, and has published more than 200 articles and 20 books, including the recently released Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State. His widely read Terror in the Mind of God is at the Global Rise of Religious Violence is based on interviews with religious activists around the world, including individuals convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, leaders of Hamas, and abortion clinic bombers in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Juergensmeyer.
My pleasure.
And although Christian terrorism is certainly not a phenomenon that's publicized very much, it's a very real phenomenon. Most of our obsession is about Islamic terrorism, Muslim terrorists. You hear about it constantly in the news and in the movies and on television. So am I correct in suggesting that the phenomenon of Christian terrorism is somewhat underreported?
Yeah, I think that's right. Although, you know, it's a paradox that there are far more acts of Christian terrorism on American soil than Muslim terrorism or by any other group. There have been scores of incidents of Christian terrorism, and since Barack Obama was inaugurated as president, unfortunately, the number have risen. Everything from suicide attacks to Christian militia groups planning armed rebellion to plots to assassinate the president's life, and some of them are supported by broad Christian ideologies like those associated with the Christian Identity Movement or Christian Reconstruction that imagines a Christian-based, kind of coup d'etat, a Christian rebellion, Christian revolution in America. And I've talked with people who said, you know, we shouldn't be following the Constitution. We should believe in the Bible. We should have laws based solely on the Bible. They're kind of, like Christian Ayatollahs.
So do they see that? Do they see the irony that the religious right in America is, fighting religious fascism abroad, but in many ways the Republican Party's in bed with them at home?
Yeah, it's funny people don't make those connections when they're closely related to it. Although one of the guys I talked with, an abortion clinic bomber on the East Coast, who was the likely author of the Army of God manual, and a friend of people convicted of bombing abortion clinics in Florida, and also a supporter of the guy who bombed the clinic and killed the Dr. Tiller in Kansas, told me that he had a certain admiration for the Ayatollah Khomeini, because at least they were able to create a religious state in the way that he would like to do so in the United States. So at least some of them recognize that there are more parallels than others would be willing to admit.
Well, even the mainstream televangelists like Falwell, the late Falwell, and Pat Robinson and Hagee and others are open theocrats. There's a new Christian extremist constitution that's been written by the Liberty Council. That's a branch of Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, the Declaration of American Values, a 10-point plan to recreate the United States of America into a Christian version of Sharia law, in effect.
So some of these are influenced by the Christian Reconstruction Movement that has its base in Tyler, Texas, and the Institute of Christian Economics there that actually developed a whole plan for kind of recreating or reconstructing American society along Christian lines. And they base their ideology in John Calvin, in solid Christian tradition. After all, John Calvin, one of the great reformers, tried to create a theocratic state. He created his own city, which today we recognize as Geneva, Switzerland, as being a Christian theocracy. Now, it isn't a Christian theocracy today, and that kind of Calvinism has pretty much disappeared. But it was certainly part of a certain branch of some of the founding elements of America. The Puritans of Plymouth Rock, they were extreme Calvinist. So there is an American kind of fringe religious tradition of a kind of extremist theocratic politics.
Well, the theocratic right, the Christian right here, in terms of the Liberty Council's constitution, also include, apart from their hatred of gays and pornography and all of that stuff, they also talk about the individual right to own, possess, and use firearms as central to the preservation of peace and liberty. Now, this fellow who shot up the Sikh temple and killed six people and wounded three others and gravely wounded a policeman, he was in a state that have just only in the last year or so have enabled citizens to carry concealed firearms without a permit. So
right. It's
just, I can't help making the connection. I mean, it seems as clear as day that if you have this lethal combination of accessible, available firearms that you can hide, and the fact that you have uneducated people susceptible to the kind of anti-Muslim bigotry that is often heard on Fox News and is being propagated by some of our congressional members like Michelle Bachmann, who's recently accused Hillary Clinton's assistant of being a secret agent of the Muslim Brotherhood, etc. Don't you think that's a lethal combination?
It's a very lethal combination, and it may be true that Wade Michael Page was not a very sophisticated character himself, and he may not have had many ideological links to these organizations, nor really known much about their ideas or their ideas of
Christian theocracy and so forth. But the background noise, of kind of hate radio speech and this kind of extremist religio-political talk, certainly I think emboldens a certain image of the world at war, the great confrontation, the battle between good and evil and right and wrong and religion and irreligion, for which people like Page, admittedly a marginal kind of sad loner, a loser in most people's eyes, somebody who tried to be a soldier from 92 to 98. He was a failure at that. He was kicked out of the army for misconduct. God knows what that was. And ever since, he's bounced from place to place, never really had much of a responsible job, picking up these gigs with a skinhead punk band and trying to relive or recreate a kind of glory that he never really had in the military by being a part of an imagined war, a great conflict. I mean, just think how exhilarating that would be to think that you were a part of this adventure, this battle, this war that most people don't know about it, but you know that there is a battle going on, that you have been selected, or you think you've been selected to be, you know, play this critical, pivotal role instead of shock people, and suddenly they'll be aware that you're not the stupid loser that everybody thinks you are, that you're really a glorified soldier in this great war. And you know it's a great war because you hear all this language on extremist right wing radio, or the kind of hate talk shows and their internet sites this guy was privileged to. So that's part of that's the audience, that's the background, that's the template, that's the base for which people like this can get a sense of personal satisfaction and pride by entering into that cosmic war as a warrior that's going to make their name. That's the sad fact of it. They may not be sophisticated ideologues, but that template of cosmic war, of cultural war, certainly fuels the fires that makes people like this do what they do.
Well, he certainly probably thought he was at war, but he hit the wrong target, didn't he? He thought he was killing Muslims, and he killed six instead. Mark Jurgensmeyer, again, director of the Orfelius Center for Global and International Studies, professor of sociology and professor of religious studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's the author of the just-released Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State, and the widely read bestseller Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence, which is based on interviews with religious activists around the world, including individuals convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, leaders of Hamas, and abortion clinic bombers in the United States. But just to follow up on what you said, I wanted to talk more about the research you've done in a minute, but the notion that this guy's a loser, I mean, wasn't Hitler a loser? Wasn't all of that weird collection of drug addicts and Goebbels and Goering, what a bunch of disreputable misfits they all were, just a bunch of losers and thugs. I mean, that was the whole point of Bertolt Brecht's famous plays, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Huy, which portrayed Hitler as a small-time protection racketeer in the Chicago fruit markets trying to grab the cauliflower concession. He deliberately brought him down to this level because history judges these tyrants by the millions of bodies they pile up, but they don't judge them as human beings in terms of their smallness, pettiness. Stalin was another example. Somehow that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, and then there's probably no great motivator than the sense of humiliation. A sense of just not making it and not being, not being the person you want to be, even your own eyes, much less other people's eyes. And then wanting to create like a fantastic world in which you are somebody. I mean, in some ways, that's the great appeal of computer games. That's the great appeal of these kind of fantastic World of Warcraft 3 or whatever it is that so excites junior high school boys who are certainly people who are kind of betwixt and between and kind of lost and at sea and feel marginalized and humiliated and shamed all the time, and they can be somebody when they join this game. And the same is true of some of the figures you're talking about who imagine a great war, and of course in the case of Hitler, are actually able to pull it off. That's even scarier. But the terrorist acts are in some ways the same kind of thing. It's just, it's another kind of imagined war. It's just that we don't see the world at war in quite the way they see it until they do something, until they blow up the World Trade Center. And then suddenly, whoa, you know, you can't hide from that. You got to admit that somebody sees this world as a world at war. And they're pretty effective, at least for the moment, in claiming your attention and in stating their view of the world and impressing it on us. And but usually it's just for the moment, and then it dies away, unless, of course, you build a whole foreign policy around a war on terror, in which case you accept that worldview as a basis of foreign policy, which is probably the wackiest thing that's ever been done in recent history. But ordinarily, you know, sensible governments and states people realize that these are imagined wars and should be diffused and marginalized in the same way that they emerged by trying to nab those people who are perpetrators and not glorify them by glorifying their ideology as a vaunted global war on terrorism.
Well, but it seems to me that the global war on terror has almost entirely backfired, in the sense that, first of all, bin Laden's finished. He's gone, and most of them, there's only a handful of them left. During the Cold War, in the height of the Cold War, was when we had the House of Un-American Activities here in the United States, where we imitated the Stalin purge trials, asking the same question, are you or are you not a communist? So to some extent, we're imitating our nemesis here, even though they're all but vanquished, the Al-Qaeda. The growth of Christian fundamentalism in the U.S. military is breathtaking. There's a Mikey Weinstein has a group that watches them, I think it's called the Military Freedom Foundation or something. Do you know about them?
Yeah. No, it is an astounding thing.
And their special forces are just permeated by these crusader types. I mean, it's really so. You know, our military, in many ways, has turned into a kind of crusader camp.
Well, it's certainly the kind of mentality that they want to indoctrinate the military personnel with. So, and of course, it has a certain kind of effectiveness. If people feel that they're in a great mission and a great cause, then maybe they'll respond more, lively as soldiers. But of course, armies are always instruments. They're instruments of public policy. And so there's a difference between that and the kind of, the rogue bands of terrorists or individual terrorists like Wade Clark Page, Wade Michael Page, who thinks of themselves as soldiers and then carry out their acts. They're not restricted by military commands or...
Of course. I mean, I don't mean to...
Whatever they want to.
Sure. I don't mean to compare... that's the special forces who actually got bin Laden. I'm sure a lot of them are very fundamentalist Christians, but there's certainly no comparison to these kind of abortion bombers and this character in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin is his own general. That is, he is able to make his own kind of command decisions and make an attack, and of course that's why it's so exhilarating for him, and why it would be exhilarating for a former military, especially somebody like him who was never really, much in the military. But even Timothy McVeigh, who everybody recognized as a kind of hotshot in terms of killing people and tearing up the desert with automatic weapon fire, when he got out, felt that he missed the war. The war was gone, that he needed to somehow recreate a war where he had importance, he had power, maybe even more power and more glory than he had in the Gulf War and the imagined war that led to the bombing of the World Trade Center, the Oklahoma City Federal Building.
Sure.
You know, it's funny I say World Trade Center because the Al Qaeda actions are exactly the same. I mean, the jihadis are also swept up in their imagined war, just like the Christian terrorists are. And how odd it is that we are quite willing to call the jihadis Muslim terrorists, but more reluctant to call the very same kind of people, the same kind of crazy cosmic war, religious confrontation mentality on the Christian side. We're reluctant to call them Christian terrorists. They are. I mean, they are. Milan is a Muslim terrorist, and, you know, Page is a Christian terrorist. Didn't think of Page as a Christian terrorist.
Well, I just I recall doing some research on Pat Tillman, who was killed by friendly fire, and he, of course, ran. He had a huge run-in with the Christian fundamentalist crusaders, if you will, within the ranks of the Rangers and the Special Forces.
And he was not one of them. He was really quite a
he was different.
Different kind of guy.
That's why, anyway, just to go to, in the last few minutes here. Mark, I wanted to get a sense from you, since you've interviewed some of the Hamas terrorist bombers and the those convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. You've also interviewed abortion clinic bombers here in the United States. What is the difference between a Christian terrorist and a Muslim terrorist, from based upon the interviews of the people that on both sides of that divide?
Well, aside from the fact that one a Christian, the other Muslim, not a lot. I mean, the kind of imagined warfare of jihadi sort, or the imagined warfare of Aum Shinrikyo, the Buddhist activists in Japan, or some of the Sikh terrorists during the Khalistani movement in the 1980s, are the Jewish extremist zealots in on the West Bank. It's a very similar kind of imagined war, with imagined role for the activists to sort of vindicate their own sense of shame, their own shortcomings, their own humiliation in a great blaze of glory. That's really very common. There are also militant terrorist acts that are undertaken for more strategic purposes within a more real kind of confrontation. And maybe you could say that some of the Hamas activities have a more strategic role than that. But in many cases, and even in some of the Hamas cases, it's a symbolic act of a terrorist act as a blazing symbol of imagined warfare that really animates and involves the people who are connected with them.
But isn't there a kind of moral free ride in this, on both with the Christians who believe that they're in shooting an abortion provider or blowing up a clinic, they're actually saving lives?
Absolutely.
And in the case of Bin Laden and company, you know, they believe that they've got an ummah, don't they? An exemption from their religion to go out and do this in the name of
victims
of
Bin Laden was proclaiming fatwas, which he had no business doing because he was not a cleric of any sort. He had not empowered theologically to issue, you know, religious commands. I mean, you know, Timothy McVeigh, who, when told about the nursery school that was destroyed in the Oklahoma City federal bombing, expressed no remorse, but a certain a kind of sorrow, in a way, that they had to be there at that time when the building had to be attacked. Almost as if he had nothing to do with it. It was almost as if there were great historical forces at work, a great confrontation that he was kind of privileged to be a part of as a soldier, but it wasn't really his doing. You know, a jihadi might have said, this is the word of God. That's exactly what, you know, Bin Laden said, talking about the World Trade Center bombing. This is God's act, not ours, and we were privileged to take a part of it. But even Timothy McVeigh was not so pious, would say that, you know, this had to happen, and I had to be there. And there was never any sense of personal responsibility, personal moral failing. He was simply carrying out what he thought was this extraordinarily important historical act in this great cosmic conflict that was beyond any kind of temporal imagination.
Right. Well, I'm afraid that we've run out of time, Mark, but it's just, again, the lethal combination that these losers can get any amount of firepower here in the United States with no questions asked. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary. I thank you for joining us.
extraordinarily disturbing. Thank you so much, Ian. Good talking to you.
Good to talk to you. Again, I've been speaking with Mark Jurgensmeyer, the director of the Ophelia Center for Global and International Studies, a professor of sociology and professor of religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's an expert on religious violence, conflict resolution, and South Asian religion and politics. And his most recently released book is Global Rebellion, Religious Challenges to the Secular State. And his bestseller was Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence, which was based on interviews with religious activists around the world, including individuals convicted of the 1993 World Trade bombing, leaders of Hamas, and abortion clinic bombers in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with two Sikh scholars about the Sikh religion.
Not 'cause things the same, because we like the same color, and that's gray. Now that's man, can't burn his cross, 'cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now are Gurinder Singh Mann and Ami Shah. Gurinder Singh Mann is a professor of Sikh studies and the director of the Center for Sikh and Punjab Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the chair of the Journal of Punjab Studies and author of Buddhists, Hindus, and Sikhs in America, A Short History. And also joining us is Ami Shah, who is an expert on medieval and modern Sikh literature. She is a visiting scholar at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and has taught at Rutgers University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gurinder Shah Mann and Ami Shah.
Thank you.
And let me start with Gurinder Singh Mann. The Sikh religion is basically, you have written that it lays an emphasis on a life of hard work, social commitment, and ethical living. And it's a complex set of doctrinal, historical, and sociological reasons make them a very political people. And they've kept up that heritage in both the Punjab and the lands of their origin and wherever they have migrated in the past century. That's not to say that because they're a political people, they are subject to the kind of random violence that took place in Wisconsin, surely.
Surely not. But what that is to say is that they are very involved in the society wherever they are, so they participate in it at all levels. It's a sort of thriving community with institutional bases scattered all over the country.
And the Sikh word means seeker of truth, I believe. And the first word in the Sikh scriptures is sat, which translates to truth. And Sikhism, I believe, is based on truthful living, and it's a monotheistic religion with one creator whose name translates as Wonderful Enlightener. But I guess in terms of the political aspects of it, Sikhs believe in sharing what they earn with others in need. Is that right?
That's true. So they are a monotheistic tradition, but they are very involved in life. So in a way, the way God runs the world, society should follow that model, and it should be based on social justice and meeting the needs of all.
And Amishar, this is the world's fifth largest religion, but a very new religion, comparatively speaking, right? It was founded in 1469. That's before Columbus discovered the New World.
Yes. Guru Nanak lived in the 15th and 16th century. Around the turn of the 16th century, he founded a new community that he gathered together in a town he had established. And for the next 200 years, the tradition was watched over by a line of 10 gurus who participated and expressed God's revelation to their devotees.
So in contemporary terms, Gurinder Singh Mann, Sikh, of course, the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, is a Sikh, along with the Army Chief of Staff, Bikram Singh. There's quite a military tradition. There's a Sikh regiment that the British organized that still exists today in the Indian Army. And coming from the province of Punjab, that's the breadbasket of India, is it not?
Punjab is the breadbasket of India. It sort of covers 2% of the total land under cultivation, while contributes 60% of wheat and rice to the national pool. And the Sikhs, as you said, they have a tradition of army that goes back to the 18th century. And they contributed a lot in the First World War and the Second World War.
So,
part of the British Imperial Army.
But essentially, in terms of the American diaspora, it's an agricultural community, is it not?
It started as an agricultural community in California, but now I would say that there's a wide array of professions which they follow. There are business people on the East Coast. The gas stations are closely associated with the Sikh community. And you know, they are in professions, the universities, and medicine, and so on.
Well, of course, the attack on the temple in Wisconsin appears to be there, perpetrated by a white racist who I think is equally, as much as he's a racist, he's also an ignoramus, I think. And I don't know the extent to which he's been influenced by anti-Muslim propaganda, but there's quite a bit of it going on, both in Fox News and even in the United States Congress. People like Michelle Bachmann are accusing the Secretary of State's principal aide of being an agent of the Muslim Brotherhood. So anti-Muslim bigotry is alive and well since 9/11, but of course it is so ludicrously misplaced in targeting Sikhs. Amit Shah, I mean, the whole point of the Sikh religion was that it wanted to find a way out of both Hinduism and Islam. Isn't that what the founding principle was?
Right. Sikhism really is not, it's often described as an offshoot of Hinduism or some kind of synthesis between Hinduism and Islam, but that's not really accurate. The Sikh is founded very intentionally by Guru Nanak in the 16th century. And really as a distinctive sort of path that is separate from existing Hindu and Muslim communities, you know, with a distinctive set of rituals, distinctive kind of founding structure, institutions, and rituals, and an identity that is very distinct.
Well, let me ask Gurinder Singh Mann about some of the incidents of violence against Sikhs in the United States by ignorant racists who have mistaken them for Muslims. One happened, I think, only a few days after 9/11 in Arizona. A gas station owner, Balbir Singh Sodhi, was shot 5 times and killed by a man who mistook him for a Muslim. And there was the case in 2004 of Rajinder Singh Khalsa and his cousin, who were beaten while walking to a restaurant in New York. Again, they were assaulted because of their turbans and were subjected to racist anti-Muslim diatribes. Then in 2008, Baljit Singh, 63, suffered a broken jaw and nose, received a beating while walking to a temple in Jamaica, New York, and a man who did it was cursing him as an Arab. And then in 2010, Harbhajan Singh suffered spinal and facial fractures. He was a taxi driver, and when he was attacked in Sacramento by a passenger who shouted anti-Muslim racial epithets at him. And then in March of 2011, two Sikh men were shot while taking an afternoon walk in Elk Grove, California, and one died at the scene and one died later. So that's just an example, but I take it there's a lot more incidents of this than the ones that I've just listed.
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, nobody has. I mean, you know, there are some sites which have tried to catalog these incidents. but the ones which you have cited are the ones which are sort of known within the community.
Well, but that's got to make you feel fairly nervous, doesn't it? I mean, how much do you and members of your community feel they have to look over their shoulders? Or how much do you experience the kind of looks of disdain that would be associated with that kind of racism?
From my point of view, the story here is complicated. You know, I think in situations like this, the looks of disdain sometimes become more prominent. And I would say that I have sort of seen many more looks of affection, too. I mean, I still remember, you know, somewhere in September 20th or 23rd, when the flights have just begun, I flew to Boston to attend some major event there. And I think more people were trying to make me feel comfortable as well as make themselves feel comfortable by looking at me, or at least, you know, trying to say, okay. So you are absolutely right. There are looks of disdain, but then simultaneously, I think one also needs to take into consideration that there are many more looks of affection and making an effort that, yes, we know you are uncomfortable because of your turban and the way you look.
So
we are willing to give you that, you know, that sort of comfort level. It's okay that we are all in the same plane.
And Amishar, what have you experienced personally since 9/11 in terms of outward signs of prejudice?
Well, I'm actually not a Sikh American, and so I face these issues. But I think there's always a distinction to be made here, too, even in the Sikh community, between what turbaned Sikh men will face versus even non-turbaned Sikh men. There'll be a different reaction. And in general, with women, there, you know, Sikh women do not wear a hijab or any kind of obvious religious coverings. And so apart from their long hair that's often put in a braid or a bun, and their, you know, occasional, you know, Indian dress, you know, women don't face, in general, the same kinds of racial profiling or kind of just surveillance that, say, a Sikh turbaned male would face.
But it seems to me that the distinction that Gurinder just made between looks of disdain and looks of affection, you could categorize that, the difference between educated people and ignorant people. I mean, I don't mean to be too blunt, but isn't that it?
Yes, no, as well. And that's where education plays a big role. Here at UC Santa Barbara, you know, Professor Mon teaches a class on the Sikh tradition, Introduction to the Sikh Tradition, which just has about 200 students every year. And so, and there are other programs in the University of California system and at Columbia and Rutgers, different universities. Classes on Sikhism have been taught and have been included in the curricula of religious studies departments. And that has made a very big difference.
And Gurinder Singh Mann, what is your sense of how the education process is proceeding in the United States? Obviously, this horrible tragedy that's taken place has got to be yet another wake-up call for the American people, although one wonders, you know, there was just a bunch of people killed in a theater recently in Colorado. It's difficult to know when we'll wake up to the problem with easy accessibility to guns, but at least in the case of the Sikh religion, do you think there's going to be a little, you know, some more education coming out of this tragedy?
I hope so. I hope so, but you see that the very fact that you sort of pulled us up is a sort of step in the right direction. And the fact that you will be giving this interview, more people would hear about it, these issues would come up, and that would help. And as Dr. Shah was referring to, there are programs in various universities where the effort is being made to introduce the Sikhs as a distinct tradition and, you know, introduce these beliefs. If, for instance, at Santa Barbara, if, you know, I have, I would say that definitely more than 10,000 people have taken the courses I offer on the Sikhs. So they have visited the Gurdwara in Ventura. So they have some, you know, they have better sense of who the people are, their beliefs are, their history in the U.S., and that would make the change. But these are steps in the right direction. And the universities are trying that. The university presses are trying that by publishing materials on the Sikhs. So efforts are being made, but they would take time. And I would underline that the Sikhs are 350,000 in this country. So given that small number, it will take time, but we need to be doing it because that's where our collective liberation lies. We need to know about smaller as well as bigger segments of the society so that people can function effectively and ignorance doesn't come into the picture. I may have a turban, I may have long hair, but that doesn't really mean that I can't be an American or I don't think like the way an American does.
Well, just in closing, let me ask Amish Shah first. What are you hearing from abroad in terms of, I mean, given that the Indian Prime Minister is a Sikh, I imagine there's quite a lot of, you know, some disconcerting comments must be coming from abroad, surely.
Well, there's some disconcerting comments. There's been a spate of violence against Indians living abroad in general in the last few months in Australia and different Commonwealth countries. And so there's been a kind of concern for the well-being of immigrants living abroad, especially, you know, those who are the subject of these kinds of hate crimes. But then at the same time, the Indian government, you know, people abroad in India are surely worried, but at the same time, it must also bring up memories of the Indian government's own problematic relationship with the Sikhs through the political insurgency and trauma of the 1980s and 1990s in the Punjab. So there's concern and probably also an opportunity for introspection on the part of the Indian government.
And just in closing, Gurinder Singh Mann, what are you hearing from abroad?
It would be pretty much on the same lines. Those people are disturbed. They are worried because, you know, most of the Sikhs, say, for instance, in this case, they're first-generation immigrants. So their brothers and sisters and some parts of their families are still there. So it'll be what would happen, you know, and there will be anxiety in general as to what is going on. And, you know, those concerns which you always have in situations like that come up.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Gurinder Singh Mann and Amish Shah.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gurinder Singh Mann, who's a professor of Sikh Studies and director of the Center for Sikh and Punjab Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the chair of the Journal of Punjab Studies and author of Buddhists, Hindus, and Sikhs in America, A Short History. And also joining us was Amish Shah, who's an expert on medieval and modern Sikh literature, and she's a visiting scholar at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and has taught at Rutgers University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Michelle Menas and Christian Vasquez. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.